Our 20th anniversary celebration of the World Cafe continues today with a show focusing on the singer-songwriter movement of the 1990s. Suzanne Vega, in many ways, epitomizes that period with her literary songwriting. Her first two albums, released in 1985 and 87, were received unexpectedly well, out of step with what was stylistically popular at the time. Her third album, 1990's Days of Open Hand, followed along a similar vein. That year, a pair of British dance producers called DNA remixed a song from her second album. It would become her biggest hit. On the album that followed, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees, Vega adorned her music with dance beats. Suzanne Vega stopped by the cafe in 1993, shortly after releasing that album.
What was the process that brought you to the sound of the new record? Was the DNA remix important in your thinking?
Actually it wasn't. I wasn't thinking about it specifically. I think it was really more of a progression of what I had been thinking on the Days of Open Hand record. That was kind of done with your basic rock and roll drum kit.
Right.
So we were starting already with Days of Open Hand to get into more syncopated rhythms and to deal with handheld instruments and that kind of thing. So when Mitchell had suggested that we'd go even farther in that direction, it made sense to me.
And it's a wonderful sound. I was wondering how the songs began. Did they begin... You demoed them, but you demoed them with your band. You didn't demo them acoustically?
First, I demoed them acoustically, and then I produced my own demo tape. So most of the songs started on the acoustic guitar.
Do you want to do some of the ones from the record acoustically?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll start off with When Heroes Go Down. Any time to equivocate the past. When heroes go down, they land in flame. So don't expect any slow and careful settling of blame. I heard you say you look out for the feet of clay, that someone will be falling next without the chance for last respect. You feel the disappointment. Go down, man or woman reveal. Do you show any kind of mercy on the battlefield? I heard you say you look out for the feet of clay that someone will falling next without the chance for last respects. You feel the disappointment when heroes go down, man or woman revere. Do you show any kind of mercy on the battlefield when heroes go down?
When Heroes Go Down, acoustic version from our guest Suzanne Vega. You've always, it seems like, continually are presented as the icon of new folk music. You know, it's like sort of like a Suzanne Vega or like a Tracy Chapman. How do you feel about that? I mean, that's kind of a heavy burden in a way.
Well, I don't think of it as a burden because I always manage to wiggle away from any iconness that anybody wants to put on me. I mean, I've seen my name used to describe anybody from, like, Tracy Chapman to, say, someone like Juliana Hatfield. I read my name in conjunction with hers recently, and I can't imagine two people more different than Tracy Chapman and Juliana Hatfield, and how I can be like both of them, or they're both, you know, it seems very peculiar to me. So I read it and I go, okay.
Suzanne Vega from an interview that first aired in 1993. Amy Mann released three albums in the 80s with her band Till Tuesday, gaining a hit in 1985 with the song Voices Carry, and more importantly, gaining respect for her songwriting. But after the final Till Tuesday record, Everything's Different Now, it took Mann 5 years to put out her solo debut, Whatever, thanks to a battle with her record company, Epic. Mann visited the cafe in 1993, shortly after releasing that first solo album.
We had, I think, what you'd call legal problems, which kind of prohibit us from releasing a record, so we went ahead and started making a record. And since we didn't have a record deal, kind of not really, we were trying to get off Epic, but we couldn't, and we certainly didn't want to make a record for them. So my manager decided to finance an album that I made on my own.
And this is that album.
Yeah.
Looking back to Everything's Different Now, that last Till Tuesday record, anybody who had a chance to actually hear that record had to be see it as a totally accessible pop record that had wonderful themes.
You'd think. I thought it was pretty accessible. I didn't think it was exactly, you know, underground music, but...
Do you think that was the feeling from your former record company?
They seemed to think that, that I was just not... I think that I was not in a mold that they understood, that they knew what to do with is more like it. So, you know, that was their taste and that was their thing, and... That's perfectly fine.
Well, you got a couple songs that seem to be about band experiences, but not necessarily yours.
Put Me on Top.
Put Me on Top, yeah.
Put Me on Top is easy. It's only four chords. Well, there's like that special fifth I throw in every now and then. Thank you.
Put Me on Top from Amy Mann's 1993 visit to the cafe shortly after her solo debut was released. A second record company battle delayed the follow-up to that disc. But by the end of the decade, Amy Mann's fortune had definitely taken a turn for the better when her music was included in the film Magnolia. As she'll explain in this clip from 2000, that didn't come entirely easily either.
I'm reasonably skeptical without trying to be cynical about these kind of things because I've had, for instance, the story of Wise Up, which is one of the songs that's in the movie, was supposed to be in Jerry Maguire. And, that was sort of a whole saga where Cameron Crowe, there was another song of mine he was going to put in, and then he didn't put that song in. He put You Could Make a Killing in the temp track, and then he took that out, and then he wanted me to write another song, so I wrote another song, and then he didn't put that in either. So I think it actually is finally in sort of like the airplane version and the TV version.
Do you want to do something from the soundtrack, from Magnolia?
Oh, okay.
Can't hurt your negotiations for the new album. To have this doing so well.
Oh, there are no negotiations.
Oh, it's done.
I don't want to be on a major label again. That's pretty much over.
It's yours.
I think the major label, Roller Coaster, is over. Okay, this is Save Me.
Perfect fit for a girl in need of a tourniquet. But can you save me? Why don't you save me? If you could save me from the ranks of the freaks who suspect they could never love anyone. Thank you.
Save Me by Amy Mann from her visit to the cafe in 2000. That song was nominated for an Academy Award and a Grammy. Later, we get to the very first ever World Cafe interview. It's with singer-songwriter Bruce Cockburn. But first, the 90s singer-songwriter who has the most lasting and largest success, Sheryl Crow. Hear her in a moment on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. On this special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, we're focusing on the singer-songwriter movement of the 1990s. Sheryl Crow is one of the artists from that decade who has seen the most continued success, but it wasn't entirely clear that was the way things would go when Crow released her debut, Tuesday Night Music Club, in 1993. At first, the album seemed unlikely to take off, but with the single All I Want to Do, Crow's career changed entirely. The song became a hit, and so did the album. Her 1996 self-titled follow-up proved that Crow could continue to bewitch audiences. When Sheryl Crow stopped by the cafe in 2003, she not only gave us her take on the current state of the music industry, she also looked back on both of those discs.
The songs that have been the most successful for me were the songs that I almost didn't put on the records. Hmm. Like, All I Want to Do was just like a last-minute throw it on, and it was like a fourth or fifth single. Well, I guess it was a third single, and we technically felt like the record was already dead, the Tuesday Night Music Club record. And that song took off and bought us a whole new life and as a touring band and enabled us to really kind of define who we were as a live act. And then on the second record, Every Day's a Winding Road, which was maybe the biggest hit on that record, was one that I wasn't going to put on the record. And my engineer said, you've just got to put that on the record. It means a lot to me lyrically. And so I kind of did it as a favor to him, and then it wound up being a big hit. So I feel like when I go in to make a record, I don't have any idea what is going to resonate with people. I've just been really lucky in that area.
Well, I've always loved that song. Does that work acoustic? Can you do that stripped down?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's this will definitely be a stripped down version of that, too. We won't have our bongo player. So. All right, well, here we go.
2, 3, 4. Hitched a ride with a vending machine repairman. He said he'd been down this road more than twice. He was high on intellectualism. I've never been there, but the brochure looks nice. Jump in, let's go. Lay back, enjoy. Everybody gets high, everybody gets low. These are the days when anything goes. Every day's a winding road. I get a little bit closer. I get a little bit closer to feeling fine. He's got a daughter he calls Easter. She was born on a Tuesday night. I'm just wondering why I feel so alone. Enjoy the show. so fine. I've been living on a sea of anarchy. I've been living on coffee and nicotine.
Every day is a winding road, an acoustic version of that today from Sheryl Crow, who is going through some of the songs that made it onto the very best of Sheryl Crow, a fine new collection. Sheryl, I got kind of another music biz question, which is, you know, there's kind of this trepidation in the music business right now. Things are very much up in the air. Sales are down. There's, there's you know, downloading, et cetera. You are one of the artists that whatever record companies they want to have around you. You sell a lot of records, and I'm curious, even at the level you are, if you feel the kind of tremor of what's happening with the record business.
Oh, absolutely. About 4 or 5 years ago, Don Henley and I started this organization called the Recording Artists Coalition, and at that time, one of our concerns was losing our copyrights. But then, really, within a nanosecond, everything shifted over to protecting music from just being stolen, period. And I think, you know, my feeling about it was, you know, whether you believe in karma or not, I think what happened in the early days of CDs was that an arbitrary price was put on CDs that was just way inflated. And I think the public really reacted to the fact that a cassette was like $3.99 and suddenly you're paying $17.99 for a CD. But the music's still coming to you free over the radio. So that's where the mentality of piracy began. And I always felt like what was happening out there was really directly correlated to the greed of the recording companies, because the artists weren't making the extra money that was involved in that just crazily inflated price. It was just going back into the record label system. So I felt like at the time that what was happening was very damaging to people who were trying to create something good and meaningful for the planet. And really, art is, we can never forsake art. We can never underestimate its power. It's the thing that I think gets inside of our spirits and moves our souls and inspires us to do great things and helps us to understand the fragility of the human spirit. But, you know, it's also, there's a battle in there, educating people as to why they shouldn't download, why they shouldn't have music for free when you've got, you know, what people perceive to be is a bunch of rich rock stars complaining about how much money they're losing by the downloading. It's not the point, and it's actually not factual. There are a lot of great people out there making music who don't make a lot of money. And it's just, you know, it's a matter of whether you go in and you shoplift from a record store or you pay for it. And I think most people wouldn't want to shoplift, but it's just the youth mentality, and you have to educate people. So I think we're making great strides. I think what Steve Jobs did really helped out the situation by creating iTunes and by making it easier for the young computer set to just to be able to lawfully acquire music.
To sort of amplify your point, the vast majority of people who are making music out there are not making big money on it. So,
absolutely not. So. I mean, I'm lucky because I've sold a lot of records, and it's one of the reasons that I fight the fight is that there are a lot of people who I myself admire who don't make a lot of money, who we really need to be around still. We need to hear their voices. They're the people that write the great songs that aren't on pop radio, that are not making the sexy videos. They're the people that are really giving voice to what's happening right now. And what is happening out there right now needs to have a voice, because there are a lot of people that are really feeling the pain of what's happening, you know, in this world. And there are people like Steve Earle who write about it. There are people like Lucinda who write about it. There are a lot of great, fine artists out there who don't make the millions of dollars because they're not the commercial pop artists. And we need to protect those people.
We're talking with Sheryl Crow today, and we have time for one more live track. What did you want to do?
Well, we're going to go back and do, I mean, this is probably the song that meant the most to me because it was the first song that came out after the success of the first record. And I think the story there is that there were a lot of sort of naysayers after the success of the first record. And then when If It Makes You Happy came out, it really galvanized people's belief in me. And so I really appreciate the success of this song, and I really enjoy playing it. So we're going to play If It Makes You Happy.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get down, a real low down.
If it makes you happy, Sheryl Crow playing live for us today, finishing up a live session. You know, you mentioned a little bit about that song coming out after the first album and people really saying, well, she's here to stay. You also did something a little different after that first album. You purposefully came out with kind of a different image at the beginning of that, which, you know, I had people talking about.
Can we skip over that?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
No, but how did, I at the time, I mean, people were certainly talking about that. It was a big issue at the time.
Oh, it was huge. I mean, it's funny, Dave, you look back on your career, and I do think that, you know, you hope when you go in to make a record that you're being honest and that you're basically taking a snapshot of who you are and what you're going through at that moment in time. And all those songs did portray what I was feeling. But I think more than anything, the artwork just said straight up, I don't want anybody to F with me. I'm not going to be Miss Accessible Girl Next Door anymore. I'm not going to sell my soul to the media. I'm not going to talk openly about my life. Hands off. And so that artwork just really said, you know, it was black makeup. I was really fried. I was really in a place of, you know, feeling betrayed, felt like nobody believed in me. And then a few months later, of course, all the makeup came off. I got my sense of humor back. But
washed your hair, too. So
washed my hair. Yeah. I put on some regular clothes, put my jeans back on. But it was really honest for the moment in time. That's really how I felt. So there it is.
Sheryl Crow from an interview recorded in 2003. She was looking back on her 1993 debut and the self-titled disc that followed. After the break, another superstar, Sting, plus our first ever World Cafe interview from 1991. That's in a moment on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. To begin the final segment of this World Cafe 20th anniversary edition on 90s singer-songwriters, we go back to the first ever World Cafe interview, recorded in 1991 with Bruce Cockburn. The Canadian artist had just released Nothing But a Burning Light, an album he recorded in the U.S. with producer T-Bone Burnett. It was his first release for Columbia, who also put out 12 albums from his back catalog that year. 2 decades into his career, Cockburn was known not only for his songwriting, but also his interest in global issues. He had added world beat rhythms to some of his music long before that became a trend. And one of his most famous songs, 1984's If I Had a Rocket Launcher, focused on dictatorships in Central America. In this 1991 interview, Bruce Cockburn shared what prompted him to become a musician.
The folk music that made me want to play music to begin with was early Elvis and Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and
American,
you know,
folk music. Yeah,
yeah. What's become folk music with hindsight now, you know, in a way, but.
Do you search out when you travel? I mean, you do travel a lot. Do you search out music, or is it just part of the environment?
Mostly the music of other cultures that I've absorbed to whatever degree I've absorbed. It came from a deliberate attempt over a period of a few years in the 70s to seek out that music on record. And in the course of traveling, of course, I have been exposed to other kinds of things, too. But the travels haven't been really musical in nature, at least the third world stuff that I've done most of the time. So, actually, there was an interesting guy that I met in Nepal, an itinerant musician there. And the roads in Nepal are pathways, as some people may know. And we met this guy one day who was from a village in which the men are expected to become musicians. And the music they do is a very traditional, sort of rigidly defined kind of music played on a one-string instrument called the one string. And the songs have religious themes in the Hindu context, and they're expected when they reach puberty, more or less, they have to leave the village for 12 years and make their living, survive or not, as itinerant musicians doing this particular kind of music. And then they can come back and start a family. And this guy had been on the road for 20 years. He did his 12 years, and he just didn't want to go back.
You know, live your work.
A very bluesy kind of existence, in a way. You know. Anyway, this is not like that at all, this song.
No, this is not a one-string.
This is called Great Big Love. This is kind of a number of personal manifesti that I've come out with, I guess.
Sun slants across the road, painting everything with gold. I'm headed for home, gotta walk. woman there. I can barely wait to hold. Got the wind in my hair, got the heat inside. My heart jumping up and down. An empty head and a messed up bed. I'll be floating just above the ground. Great big love sweeping across the sky. Great big love sweeping across the sky. Seen a lot of things in the world outside. Some bad, but some good stuff too. Felt the touch of love in the works of God. And now and then in what people do. Never had a lot of faith in human beings. But sometimes we manage to shine. Like a light on a hill beaming out to space. Somewhere hard to find. Great big love sweeping across the sky. Great big love sweeping across the sky. Play guitar, and I like my life just fine. If you try to take one of these things from me, well, you're no friend of mine. Got a woman I love and she loves me, and we live on a piece of land. Measure these things, but I guess I'm a happy man. Great big love sweeping across the sky. Great big love sweeping across the sky.
Great Big Love by Bruce Cockburn. That was an excerpt from our first ever World Cafe interview, which debuted back in 1991. Like Bruce Cockburn, Sting's career spans beyond the 90s, but also like Cockburn, the 90s are a decade that delineate a marked change in his career. While Sting's earlier work with the Police and the first solo albums in the 80s drew in college rock fans, his 90s work saw an older adult fan base take hold. In 1999, he stopped by the cafe for an interview with Michaela Majune. He had recently released Brand New Day. Michaela began by asking Sting about the longing expressed in the single Desert Rose, a duet with Algerian Rise singer Cheb Mami.
I'm talking about, you know, earthly love, if you like, or romantic love, but also the Garden of Eden rears its head at some point, and a sense of philosophical longing. is the word. You know, the interesting story is that I wrote this song, but I didn't tell Cheb Mami what it was about. Cheb Mami's the Algerian guy who sings on the record. I asked him to sing some lyrics to this counter melody I'd written, and he had no knowledge of what I was singing about. He came back and started to sing, and I thought it sounded very good and very authentic. And I asked him what he was singing about, and he said, "Well, I'm singing about longing," which is an interesting sort of confirmation of the process. You know, the music was telling us what to write.
I love the last line of Desert Rose. This rare perfume is the sweet intoxication of the fall. And of course, that brings to mind Adam and Eve, especially since you mentioned Eden.
Yeah, well, I think that's that we do have a kind of recollection almost of perfection, of a time when there was happiness. I don't know whether it's an illusion or not, but it's certainly in everyone's head. We have this idea of perfection. Whether we can realize it or not, I don't know.
Your website says that Brand New Day is devoted to the theme that love conquers all. But a lot of the songs are about the breakup, the loss of love.
The loss of love, or I'm not so sure about that. I think there's an optimism in just about all of the songs that love actually transcends not only lifetimes, it also transcends breakups, you know. There's meaning in a relationship even if it doesn't last. It's been a profound and useful part of living.
How has new technology affected your process of composing?
Well, I would imagine I was one of the first people to begin to use digital systems to compose, computers. About 15 years ago. And I've used it as part of my process in all of that time, but never so you would notice. There's an electronic undercurrent in all the music I've done, but it's usually played against the real musicians. So it's layered over by real musicianship. And I found that very interesting. It's not entirely organic, but there's a tension between the real musician and the mechanical nature of computer generated sound, you know. So I've always found that interesting.
Are you still doing yoga?
I'm doing yoga now, even as I sit here.
Oh my. Are you sorry that you did that article in Yoga Journal a few years back talking about tantric yoga?
No, I didn't talk about tantric yoga in that journal. I talked about it in a drunken session with Q magazine. And why would I be sorry?
I don't, it comes up a lot, so to speak.
It comes up a lot. It's hilarious. No, I think it's very funny.
What is it like being a cultural icon and trying to have a normal family life?
Oh, I have a very normal family life. I don't bring the celebrity home. My kids wouldn't tolerate it, nor would my wife. I try and be as normal a father as I can be. The only difference being that I travel a lot and I'm away from home a lot. But when I come home, I do monitor that celebrity guy. He stays outside.
It's a good trick if you can do it. I just have a couple more questions. Sting, you're known for your vocal agility, for being able to go from very intimate vocal stance to great soaring over the music. How did you discover that and develop it?
Selling newspapers. I used to sell the Evening Chronicle in my hometown at Newcastle, and I developed a singing style to get over traffic. Want to hear it?
Yes.
Evening Chronicle!
I can hear that.
You can hear it, can't you?
Yes, I can hear it in your music.
Sort of yodel, and it worked. I sold a lot of newspapers. And I had a milk round in the mornings. I was always very hardworking.
You've acted, you've had this extraordinary musical career, and you certainly have been involved in some important causes, social causes, the Rainforest Foundation, Amnesty International. Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you really want to accomplish in your life?
Well, I mean, the only regret I have is my athletic career. I never played soccer for England. You know, I was a runner as a young man. But, you know, the next lifetime, if such a thing exists, I'll be an athlete.
Sting from an interview with the Cafe's Michaela Majune, recorded back in 1999, shortly after the release of Brand New Day. Thanks for joining us on this special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe.